Nice. The Killers? Cool. Good morning, and that would be the name of the band, not us, Judy. Good morning, and welcome to our roundtable panel and our roundtable discussion. I'm Joe Donahue, Daily Gazette editor. Judy Patrick is here. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Great to be here.
We are waiting both Alan Chartok and Rosemary Mayo, who are just finishing up the media project taping. They should be here in seconds. So I'll just go ahead and introduce them, and hopefully by the time I'm done introducing them, they'll actually be here in the studio. WAMC's Alan Chartok is going to be in the house, as will be University at Albany professor and investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo. And good, now they're chatting. That's good. You look in the window, and they're just chatting. For those of you who are not privy to the webcam, it is. Our studio is right next to the studio where they do the media project, and we have a big plate glass fishbowl, if you will. And, come on in.
You know, if they don't hurry up, maybe I'll do my Alan Chartok imitation.
Oh, I would love to hear that. I'd love to hear that. Well, we could just get started, but I thought that I would, wait so they could get, seated. For those listeners at home, I do have to say that it isn't very far to walk from one studio to the other.
Probably 7 steps.
And yet, this morning it seems really, really long. Well, there you are, finally. Good morning.
Tune into the media project.
No, well, we were watching you, and we were starting to vamp, and we saw that you were done, and then you started to chat, and then Judy and I were like, So,
what are you guys, nonverbal?
No, we were verbal. We were very verbal.
You don't have to worry about us. You know, just
well,
do
we
your thing.
We introduced you.
But
I didn't want to start off. I didn't want to start
Let's
off.
Let's jump
with
in.
The,
then.
Yeah,
we got
the,
lots
the good
today.
Topics. All right, where do you want to start? You want to start with Bill Clinton?
Okay.
Bill, and I don't know why I chose that story first, just because it was on my mind and I was thinking about it, and that's really the only reason. Bill Clinton was making a speech yesterday. And I thought this was rather fascinating because I believe he was making it at the Johnson Library,
right.
The Lyndon
right.
Johnson
Austin.
Presidential
right.
Library in
which
Austin.
Is attracting a whole raft of ex-presidents.
I think all the living ones
mm-hmm.
are there,
yes.
right?
And so the president has spoken out on voter restrictions and saying that he's using the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act to criticize efforts in several states to restrict voting, notably photo identification requirements, saying that they threaten to roll back half a century of progress. The president spoke last night during the Civil Rights Summit at the Lyndon B. Johnson Presidential Library at the University of Texas in Austin. The library is hosting the 3-day event to mark the anniversary of the landmark civil rights the 1964 law that banned widespread discrimination against racial and ethnic minorities and women. The president, President Obama, is scheduled to give the keynote address today, and former President George Bush will wrap up the summit tomorrow night. So what do we make of this? This was sort of I got a lot of news alerts on this yesterday of the president talking about this. So why do you think it is making such a splash?
Well, it shouldn't. I mean, it's been pretty pro forma that the Republicans have said, you know, all along, every time somebody tries to make access to the voting booth easier, that this will lead to fraud, and it's a bad idea. But also, there are those who suspect them of a certain amount of cynicism, because every time you add a new demand onto what would allow somebody to vote, a photo ID, you know, we outlawed, for example, years ago, having to know the major provisions of the U.S. Constitution in order to vote. So we know that the more you do of that kind of thing, the fewer people, usually at the bottom side of the social scale, will vote. It's that simple. And so Clinton, seeing his wife about to run for president of the United States and knowing a few votes might change it either way, does what's both right. Excuse me, Rosemary, before you start shaking your head, does what's both right. And what's political?
I find it so hard to believe that I'm the person on the show that gets knocked as the cynic when I hear that. I don't think this was political at all. It may have that effect. But Clinton is at an event to talk about civil rights issues. He could have picked a variety of issues. Most people really expected him to take on gay marriage. He was the person who signed the one man, one woman law that was struck down. He was behind it and said, yes, it's unconstitutional in 2013.
Okay, so
and he
going
led to that. Instead, he deliberately picked voting rights, which is under attack, and Bill Clinton has the ability to steer debate and to steer interests. I think he saved Obama's presidential campaign. So when he speaks, it's enormously important, and he used that stage.
I don't see us disagreeing, by the way.
I don't think he did it because he was trying to help Hillary. I think he did it because this is important.
Well, you see, I'm so sorry, Rosemary. I think we have to try to do what's reflective of the way it really is around here. And the way it really is that every time you make a provision, a difficult provision like that, voter ID or something like that, you get fewer people voting, and the fewer people are almost inevitably at the lower end of the social scale.
There's no question. And that's what Clinton said, too. He said, not be deceived by... Yeah, but you said he was doing this because he thought he might get Hillary a few more votes.
Excuse me. Maybe you can take Hillary off the table in this thing. But there is no question that Democrats are always for more access that Republicans are inevitably against.
Isn't the reality that there are photo ID requirements in 10 states now?
Right. Clinton spent much of his speech addressing last year's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that struck down key provisions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which also signed into law by Johnson. The ruling allows several states, I believe you're right, 10, with a history of discriminatory voting laws, mostly in the South, to change election laws without federal approval. Clinton said of the ruling, quote, "It sent a signal throughout the country. We all know what this is about. This is a way of restricting a franchise after 50 years of expanding it. Is this what Martin Luther King gave his life for?"
And let's not forget, our election turnout rates are abysmal, even without voter ID. People in this country do not vote the way they should.
And, Judy, you're right. And again, I want to reiterate that the people on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale are the ones who are less likely to turn out.
And one other point is that there's virtually no voter fraud in this country. Republicans went crazy trying to scour the country to show outrageous or egregious examples. There is none.
And when we talk about this, that is the issue that gets raised up. Oh, why would you fight voter ID? Because it will preserve the integrity of the vote. But there are studies that show there is very little voter fraud.
What can happen with voter ID in the sense of we have to show our ID for everything? So how does this become such an issue?
You don't have your driver's license because you don't drive. You're elderly.
Right.
And you're poor. And to get the alternative form, you have to take expensive public transportation. You have to take a day off from work that you can't afford. So if you're a middle class or upper person, of course you're going to have a photo ID. If you're of lower income, then you don't. And it's an extra
onerous
burden.
Not all people don't, but more people don't.
More people, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm just becoming, we're becoming a society more and more.
Police state is the word you're searching for.
That for everything that you want to do, of whether it's, whether it's you want to, I don't know.
Go in a parking garage.
Right. Everything right. you have to show an ID. And it's becoming our way of life. And it seems as though obviously we're talking about voting. We're talking about cornerstone of our democracy. So yes, we have to figure this out. But it seems like we also have to figure it out just in general of how
Good
we do
point.
This.
You shouldn't stop at voter ID. Obviously, there are other things that people put up in the way. For example, one of the more popular concepts that's coming around now is the idea of same day registration. You register on the same day that you're going to vote. Again, the Democrats are for it. The Republicans, by and large, and the Republicans are against it. Once again, it fits into that paradigm. There goes that word again, where people, you'd have to be just really not smart to figure this out.
Our election laws are not aimed at getting people out to vote in third world countries where democracies are new. They vote on weekends. That would increase your voter turnout. We don't do that.
Or over a period of time, over a period of days where you can make it.
And, why do you have to go someplace to vote anymore? You can shop at home. Why can't you vote at home?
Well, there are some
security issues.
Yeah, maybe not. Today's not the day to bring that up, but maybe I agree with you that you think I've used this analogy before that you know, we can go into any corner of the world and take a dollar amount out of our bank account, and they have it to the penny, and in most cases everything is fine and it works okay, but we can't figure out a way to vote. You know, I don't understand.
Well, as I said yesterday, the Indian elections are on right now, and they have a fantastic system of really incorruptible. Everything's corruptible, but incorruptible voting machinery that really has proven to be terrific. But we don't have that here. We have hanging chads in Florida and things like that.
Well, and there has been a lot of, there has been a lot of changes since the 2000 election. Mm-hmm. However, you know, I don't know if those have been for the good. I find mm-hmm. our current system to be more archaic than mm-hmm. anything prior.
Than the levers.
The whole thing with the
down,
folder
yeah.
and you put it in yeah. and you got to get stuck and you. But I look at Judy because I know, you know, we vote in very small towns, and you walk in and you almost get this false sense of security because you walk in and they know you. They open up the book. They say, hello, Judy. Hello, Joe. You sign your thing and you walk in. Same thing
yeah,
with
sure.
you, Alan.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a small town. It's but it's much different if you're going into a huge polling place and it's where they don't know you. And obviously, we're not, we're not going to make or break an election.
If you can get into a polling place. St. Louis had huge lines. 2 hours after closing time, people were still in lines. That's a technological problem that should not exist.
Right,
and
I think a lot of this.
Voting, sorry.
I think a lot of this has to do with the new, technology,
yeah, yeah.
Because it's taking longer and people just haven't figured it out. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and move on to other topics as well. Roundtable at WAMC to get in on the fun. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Sundog Cider at Solaqua, locally produced hard cider from New York Hudson Valley apples, unfiltered, naturally gluten-free, handcrafted at a revitalized solar-powered mill in Chatham, New York, sundogcider.com. Kenco Work and Play Outfitters, Kingston, now taking reservations for the newly opened Kenco's Interactive Archery Range inside the expanded Big Green Building on Route 28, atkenco.com. In Mannix Marketing, Glens Falls, New York, since 1996, a web design and internet marketing firm working to help businesses get found on the internet, mannixmarketing.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Rosemary Armeo, Judy Patrick, and Alan Chartok at the table, and we welcome you as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Before we move away from the issue of voting rights and the comments by President Clinton in Texas yesterday, we have a letter.
Yeah, Jay Michael writes this. For your information, Louisiana, hardly a paragon of voting rights, holds all its elections on Saturdays except the federal ones. That's nice. If, of course, you happen to be a religious Jew, you know, Saturday isn't exactly a great day for you. And if you happen to be somebody who is a very conservative Christian, for example, you might not want to vote on a Sunday. So there's always something. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's why a period may work better than
Sheldon
just one
Silver,
day.
Our Speaker of our Assembly, will not do business on a Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a new topic and talk about, and again, we welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org. The Russian government declined to provide the FBI with information about one of the Boston Marathon bombing suspects that would most likely have led to more extensive scrutiny on him at least 2 years before the attack, according to an inspector general's report.
Surprise!
Russian officials had told the FBI in 2011 that the suspect, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was a follower of radical Islam and a strong believer, and that Mr. Tsarnaev had changed drastically since 2010 as he prepared to leave the United States for travel to the country's region to join unspecified underground groups.
Mm-hmm. So I've read this story, and it's a report that exonerates the FBI's behavior in Boston. Right after it happened, we all thought, oh, if they'd only listened, you know, listen to the Russians who warned us about these guys, we would have done better. In fact, the Russians did warn them. The FBI checked and determined that the threat was more to Russia than to the U.S., and they did ask for additional information. There's some breakdown at this point. I don't think there's any indication that the Russians were trying to keep us in the dark, but there was a conversation between the older son and his mother about jihad, and they had a transcript of it, but would not have been in English, of course, and we did not get it, and we did not press for further information. So it seems like a small mistake at the time with huge consequences.
And is there any indication that the U.S. alerted Russia that they were a threat to them?
Well, did we know that they were? We used their information and determined that that's why the Russians are looking at these guys, because they could cause trouble in Chechnya.
Without any reflection on what we do, I have to say, the Russians are well-known liars. We have seen it over and over again in the present international crisis that we're facing. They lie. They say one thing and they do another. Remember the whole issue over the children who are coming over here, that there were allegations that they were sending kids with mental problems being allowed to immigrate to the United States. Certainly not all children who come from from Russia, but some, and certifying them as okay. I just think you have to remember that they do what's in their own particular interest, and maybe not what's so much for anybody else.
Well, I think every country does that, including ours. I would also point out that every intelligence agency seems to be having trouble being completely accurate or knowledgeable all the time, including our own, as 9/11 showed, as the fall of Berlin, the Berlin Wall showed. We didn't know about it ahead of time. Intelligence agencies in England and
Wait a second. I'm sorry about that Berlin Wall, because I cite that often.
We didn't know about it.
Being an issue. We did not know about it. That's
correct.
Right.
So our intelligence agency has downfalls, too.
Is stupidity. Another is lying.
Yeah, I just don't see any evidence of lying in here.
And we shouldn't walk away from this thinking that our intelligence community did everything they could, and the Russians are to blame for us not catching this ahead of time.
Yeah, this was more about sending blame overseas rather than what are we going to do to change things? You have a very Cold War attitude, Alan. This country needs to get past that.
I see.
They you see us as good and them as the evil empire.
I do
you
not.
Know, that's so 1980s.
Now you know that that's not true. Why are you putting words
so
and thoughts in my head? I just saw something that I considered to be. I was concentrating on something else, which was that we have a big fight in this studios because our HV system is not that good. So if you're in the newsroom, it's always too warm. If you're in the studios, it's often too cold. And so I just saw I just saw a culprit walk up, because I have
go.
A perfect view
nice.
Of this to the thingy, and I think on the outside the thermostat and put it down, which means we're about to freeze so that they can feel better.
I think it may be the opposite, actually.
Oh, really? But
unless the culprit was,
yeah.
Why don't you put a thermometer in here?
And no, it doesn't work. It doesn't work out that way.
Yeah,
wear a sweater.
Okay, so my question is, well, we're off topic and we're
very
also out of time, so I want to get back to this topic, though.
But this important issue, which we've just raised about the temperature, exists in every house in America.
So it is an important issue.
Between husbands and wives.
Much more more than global terrorism. Okay, so we'll
in my house, it is terrorism.
we'll take a break. We'll be back right after the show. Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel. Let me reintroduce the panel for you. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. University at Albany professor and investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here, as is Daily Gazette editor Judy Patrick. Welcome all. Thank you very much for being with us. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We love when you weigh in on the issues we discuss. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Before we go on to other issues, we will check the mailbag.
Okay, check the mailbag. Check. Jeff takes me to task and he says, Alan, are you kidding? With about 100 question marks and exclamation points. What about Iraq? What about NSA? What about Obamacare issues? Give me a break. From Jeff. Did anybody in this room remember my saying that we don't lie? I mean, give me a break. Okay, so that's my response to that. And Barbara says, hello, I'm a longtime listener, enjoy the roundtable a great deal. However, I find myself wincing every program when most of the group refer to various presidents, former presidents, by their last name alone. Haven't they earned the respect to be referred to by their title? Rosemary and Alan are the worst offenders.
In the AP style book, which governs journalistic use, you use last names only as a sign of respect. In American culture, we only refer to people by their first names if they are children or incompetent. So it would be disrespectful.
I think she's saying, say President Obama.
Well, why do we call people? Why is Mitt Romney still governor? I reject that criticism.
You reject it. Okay, yes. And Joe is pretty good about referring to President Obama and not merely Obama. I know we are a more casual society than we were in the past, but I think the office deserves respect. Would you try to use the title when referring to the various presidents, please? And that includes me as the president of WMC, by the way. You do not have to like the man sitting in the Oval Office, but the job title deserves our respect. Okay, and that's from Barbara in Oneonta, and I read it. I'm Alan. President Allen.
President Chartok.
Yeah,
okay. Is that it?
There's another.
Boy, you're good. You're really good. Here it is. From Michael. I have to show picture ID to get into the hospital I work. It doesn't prevent from patients from getting in. Why shouldn't I have to prove who I am to vote and prevent someone from voting fraudulently in my name or twice for that matter? And you panelists mentioned, didn't you, before that the studies have shown that there's very little fraud.
Absolutely. There's no need for it. It's an extra added step.
Okay. Fair enough.
Let's go on to other issues and talk about other things. And I think we'll go to the, as soon as I can find it, there we go. Go to the story that Judy sent me this morning, which is in the New York Times. And it's a very interesting story. Less than 2 weeks after Governor Cuomo abruptly shut down a commission that he formed to investigate political corruption in New York State, the United States attorney in Manhattan is sharply questioning the governor's decision and is taking possession of all the panel's case files, according to letters sent to the commission's members on April 3rd and again on Wednesday afternoon. The move by the United States attorney Preet Bharara, thank you, amounted to an unusual rebuke of Mr. Cuomo, a former prosecutor himself who swept into office 4 years ago, promising to clean up what many have called a culture of corruption in Albany.
Judy, since you said the story, you should tell us what you think about this.
You know, I can remember when this was all proposed was a year or 2 years ago when Governor Cuomo said he was going was going to clean up the corruption. A lot of fanfare, a lot of very good press he got for very positive. People were really wanted things to happen. And then over time, this Moreland Commission, as it became known, work became diminished to the point where the governor basically called it quits. And now the U.S. attorney is stepping in and saying, wait a minute, I want to take a look at this.
Well, and why didn't you finish what you allow them to finish what you started?
Right. And amid all these allegations that the governor's office was being heavy handed in calling the commission and saying, why are you issuing this subpoena and why are you targeting these people who are related to me or somehow related to me? So I think from the public's perspective, this is very interesting because there was a sense a year or two ago that something finally was going to be done. But we've heard this again and again and again from state governors.
Set up a commission.
Yeah. Set up a commission. The commission goes away. And now what have we got? What are they doing at the state level to attack this issue?
I think you're absolutely right. I'll probably get a call from you-know-who's place on this. But I can tell you right now, this is disgraceful. Preet Bharara is exactly right, the U.S. attorney. He's trying to clean up corruption around here, and he's not pretending about it. So you set up a Moreland Act commission, which is a huge thing to do for the governor. He got all kinds of credit for doing it. And he said this is not going to be another report that is on the shelf, gathering dust. This is going to be, you watch. And then I would argue with some of his people, and they would say to me, you just watch. The first half came up. It was a sort of benign report. Wait till all the subpoenas are served. And then, as you say, Judy, our friend Ken Lovett from the Daily News broke the story, as I remember it, which was the second floor is saying who not to send the subpoenas to. So it looked phony from the beginning. And now, before it even has a chance to report and do its work and show us where the corruption is, it's told, and the governor's people traded for a couple of benign things that they would end the commission. Bharara is right. It's a disgrace.
Yeah, Bharara in his letter to the commission says, the sequence of these events gives the appearance, although I am sure this is not the intent, that investigations potentially significant to the public interest have been bargained away as part of the negotiated arrangement between legislative and executive leaders.
That's almost kind. Because remember, these guys collect immense amounts of money. And if you're collecting, the governor has upward of $33 million, I believe, in his campaign account right now. And if some of it, for example, comes from the real estate industry, or some comes from the Democratic State Committee, or some comes from this or that, you better believe that it's troublesome that subpoenas we were told were not served or weren't going to be served, and that this whole thing is whitewashed. Bad news.
So, what comes out of this? Can there be any concrete action that comes out as a result of these statements in this report?
In which you mean in the report of the Moreland Act Commission? A lot could happen. For example, they said in the beginning that if they found wrongdoing, they were going to turn it over to the district attorneys with the power to prosecute. That ain't going to happen now. It's gone away.
With the with the statements yesterday coming from
U.S. attorney
from the U.S. attorney,
yeah.
What can they do now? What's their next step?
Why can't they prosecute?
Who's they in this case?
The U.S. attorney.
The U.S. attorney is coming out and speaking out. Yeah, so I mean, is it just speaking out, or is he going to do something more to that?
Well, the truth of the matter is that if anybody is paying attention to corruption in Albany, it's the U.S. attorney, and he is bringing all kinds of prosecutions and has been. But I think he thinks that this whole thing has to be more Catholic, small c. In other words, it has to be more wide-ranging, and that every tool should be used. And one of the tools that was advanced to do that was the Moreland Act Commission.
And the U.S. attorney did ask for the commission to retain its records, and it's going to go pick up, the U.S. attorney's office is going to pick up those records. But then there's the indication that some of those records are gone or were BlackBerry messages, and so we'll never be able to see exactly everything they did. Whatever this commission was actually investigating, nobody really thinks that they got into anything really juicy at any point.
And who was running that commission? I mean, there were all these fancy names. Our wonderful DA here in Albany, guy I have great respect for, David Soares, was on the commission, as were a lot of other DAs. And when I talked to some of those folks, they would tell me, you just watch what we do during this time. But the commission was run from the top by a staff director. And the staff director, who was leading the way in most of this, I believe, was acceptable to the Cuomo administration.
This is reminding me of the way things are done in Eastern Europe, and so my hope is that some of the prosecutors on that commission actually did keep track of records and has a set of files that could be turned over to the U.S. attorney.
It's a very powerful governor. You don't want to get on the wrong side of him.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with other issues and wrap up our conversation for this Thursday morning. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Don't forget, you can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. But again, to email us, roundtable@WAMC.org.
Support for WAMC comes from St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York. offering minimally invasive spine surgery, choose stmarys.com. University of New Hampshire, offering an online Master of Social Work program, now accepting applications for admission in August, mswonline.unh.edu. And New England Auctions, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, for 40 years, an international auction gallery offering fine art, books, maps, and antiques. 413-665-3253 for gallery and auction information.
Welcome back to our roundtable program and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome your comments, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. A student brandishing two knives injured multiple people inside a high school near Pittsburgh. We talked about this briefly as it was happening yesterday morning. The student was tackled by an assistant principal. The nightmarish scene unfolded inside Franklin Regional Senior High School in Murraysville, about half an hour east of Pittsburgh. Shortly before 7:15 a.m., the suspect, a 16-year-old sophomore at the school, made his way down a hallway flashing two knives. Thomas Seafeld, the Murraysville police chief, said in a news conference the two straight blades were each about 8 to 10 inches long. Authorities later identified the suspect as Alex Harabell and said he will be charged as an adult. And it was quite a chaotic scene. And I believe the latest from what I saw is at least two still in critical condition. Am I right on that?
Two what?
Are still in critical.
Yes.
Two of them remain in critical condition.
One
has
a puncture wound to the liver.
Well, in the end, this is a terrible thing. No matter what, people who are really hurt, it's awful. However, there's a sub-story here, and that was in some of the papers this morning, which was this particular high school had a reputation for being a place where tremendous amounts of bullying went on, and that he was one of the subjects of the bullying. Now, this doesn't justify this kind of action, obviously. But it is an interesting, and if you saw the picture of the kid in the papers this morning, really a very pathetic looking, scared young man.
I think charging him as an adult is just so evil, and part of the problem that we don't confront problems that that people are having, that young, in this case, a young person. Yeah, I did see the picture. He's, he's got acne, and he's little, and he's, this is not an adult. He and his family are victims as well as those who suffered the wounds. I'm so glad that he had only knives. That sounds horrible, doesn't it? Rather than a gun, because he was on the rampage for a while. I shudder to think how many people could have been killed. You also have to applaud the vice principal who jumped him and disarmed him, the kids who helped their classmates, pressing down on wounds and wrapping hoodies around them. It was really some heroic effort there. Terrible that it was required.
I want to talk about one of the kids. Did you have anything to say, Jay? One of the kids, Nate Ski, let me see if I pronounce this right, Scamillo, was apparently caught in the attack and sent to the hospital and was stabbed, and he's coming under tremendous fire because he took a picture. He took a post-stabbing selfie. Wow. And here's the picture of the kid. I'll show it to Rosemary so she sees it, and to Judy. But it's
hold it up to the camera.
Yeah, there you go. And it's a picture of a kid in a hospital gown. He has the gauze bandages on his arm, and he's pointing to his injury. And he has the camera, which he's obviously taking the picture in a mirror, and he is pointing to it. And so now there has been, of course, with the intense, obviously the media is covering the story and they're following anything on this. So the kid is all over, and while some people like the picture, Twitter, and some people, you know, gave it thumbs up on Instagram and other places. The reaction has been really very negative to this kid of saying that he's basically making light of the situation, or that he is not taking it seriously.
He is going to talk about
respective.
He's
going to talk about this for the rest of his life. Of course,
if you get a knife wound,
sure.
at school, and you want to take a picture of it and show it, like, look, I just got knifed in school. You know what? I don't see that as a big deal. And the article goes on in the Washington Post to talk about. I mean, the whole article is about the backlash of the post stabbing selfie, as they call it.
Wow.
But my thing is, you know what? I think it gets into a generational gap, obviously,
yep.
But also. You know, the kid has his freedom to say whatever he wants, and it did happen to him. So why not share it with the world?
Sure. One other thing, that's a very good point, Joe, and I'm glad you brought it up. But to me, there's another hidden story here, and that's the story of assistant principals everywhere. Assistant principals are usually in charge of discipline in schools. And I'm fascinated by the fact that this assistant principal had the guts to take this kid on, even though, you know, the kid had a knife.
Two knives.
Two knives, yeah. And he did. I think we tend not to.
I wish someone had taken a picture of that. I want to see that picture, too.
Of what?
The heroic act.
Yeah. Well, I back to the kid who took the selfie. He was actually the kid who pulled the fire alarm. He was the kid which actually evacuated this school.
That's a great story,
they're like throwing all this criticism to the kid, but he actually was the one. And the people who are coming to his defense are saying, well, thank you, because you were the one that actually pulled the fire alarm.
And for all you journalists in the room, the three of you, the question is, do you think there's a difference between the way the Washington Post is being run now under Bezos and before?
The fact that they wrote this story?
Yes.
Is that the issue?
And the slant of the story.
Is the story slanted to
I don't think the story is slanted. I think it's talking about the backlash against. I think they're taking, I mean, if there is a side to take, they're somewhat surprised that there is a backlash, I guess, is my take on it. But
Libby and I were wondering earlier this week if their editorial saying the Cuban Twitter controversy was way out of proportion. We had done nothing but the right thing. We wondered if that had anything to do with Bezos.
Yeah, you did. You did mention that.
Yeah.
And I was following up on that.
And that was but that was on the editorial page, not on the
which is what Bezos controls.
As you know, I don't want to get into the media project here, but I think there's a bleed from the editorial pages quite often way in which
the editorial page
are being
is
written.
Answerable to the publisher. So as the owner, he would have great influence, much more so, right, Judy, on the editorial page.
Well, I've
than
had
on
this
news.
Fight with a lot of people for many years now. That when a newspaper, a great newspaper, establishes its creds and has an approach to life, that often the stories that appear in the newspaper take somewhat of the same line that is set in the editorial columns. For example, you look puzzled, Judy. Let me give you an example. And I have great admiration for the New York Times, and I read it every day, several times online. I love it. There's no question that it has a worldview, and the worldview is that we have to make sure that people are treated fairly, that economically those people who want to take everything away from everybody is wrong, and that, you know, a sort of Franklin Roosevelt approach to the way in which, and I think that when you get hired to be a reporter on that paper, you're more likely to be hired with that approach. That's all.
Well, I think we beg the question, though, which is whether the Washington Post is changing since it now has an owner who is very into online, very into business. Are we seeing a difference there? And I know people are watching it.
But I know all of us are paying more attention to what's happening online. It's a new sphere to cover.
Right.
Exactly.
If something explodes online, we write about it. If something somebody says something controversial and it explodes, we write about it. And it's a whole new territory for us.
We're just about out of time, and I real quick want to get to this letter, Alan, if it's okay. It's sure. From Jeff, and says, what are you guys smoking? The kid with the knife who injured all of those people as a victim, question mark? Victim schmictum. He deserves to be ground into dog food.
Well, no. I didn't. Wow. I didn't.
I said he was a victim.
I think he is
deeply disturbed and needs help, not a trial as an adult.
I agree with
you. Well, yes, and Jeff, I think just not fair in this. I mean, I think if there is a culture of bullying going on in the school, which is what I raised, and if this kid could have really no help. And does this despicable thing. It's despicable. There's no two ways about it. We said that before, Jeff. Then I think the culture of bullying also has to be investigated.
And let the justice system decide this. And we don't have a provision that grinds people into dog food at this point.
Well, thank,
no, we
thank
never
God.
Said that. In
even
Jeff
Texas.
Yeah, even.
Disgusting.
All right. And finally, let's get to a very, very important story. That I think is going to touch us all, and that is Archie is dying.
Mm.
The beloved comic book character Archie.
But as I read the story,
I thought he was dead already.
As I read the story, it's only in one segment of what they're doing. It's not in the ongoing comic book, is it? Is it just, isn't there Archie's story?
Well, Life with Archie, which hits stores on July 16th, that he tells the story of how Archie sacrifices himself to save a friend. But Archie will go out as a hero. And then the 37th issue, 1 week later, will end the series.
Wow.
You know, I don't know whether they were kidding, but at the end they said something about an Archie zombie series that will come up next.
Well, you may remember Law and Order.
I hope they're not kidding. I would love to see that.
Yeah.
Remember Law and
Jughead
Order?
Is.
Jughead, right. Reggie and Jughead.
Right. You remember? Well, there were comics, Jughead comics. They were offshoots. But do you remember Law and Order when the DA was dead, but she came back because it was all, she was in the Federal Witness Protection Plan?
Yeah, they say that's not going to be any of that trickery. It's not a dream or anything. They're going to really kill him.
You know, as someone who grew up reading Archie comics, I always wondered, you know, Betty and Veronica were always secondary. And they're always after boys. And it was, you know, I'm at this point, I would like to see, you know, why are we so focused on Archie dying? Let's talk about Betty and Veronica.
I think that's
a little
unkind. You may make a good point about gender and all. But we boys always ask the question, you know, who do you like more?
Oh, Archie or Reggie?
No.
Betty or Veronica.
Oh. Betty or Veronica.
Yeah, the smart one
or the
pretty
like
one,
like
which gets back exactly to your point.
we'll find out in July, but a sad chapter that we end with this morning. We love hearing from you. Keep the conversation going. Roundtable@wamc.org. Rosemary, Judy, and Alan, thank you all very much. We'll talk tomorrow. And again, keep writing roundtable@wamc.org.